So hello everybody and welcome to another episode of HL's Pensions Pod. Today we are looking at TPR's guidance from a whole year ago on equality, diversity and inclusion. And we're taking a look back and seeing what's changed, if anything, and what people are doing in practice. So to join me today, we have three very special guests. We are joined by Katie Walker from LCP.
I'm a governance consultant at LCP. I like to say that my job is everything that's pensions, which isn't actuarial or investment. So all of the random wonderful projects that come up with trustee boards tend to come to me.
Amazing. Joe Craig from Quiet Room.
Hello. In Quiet Room, we are communications consultants specializing in the world of pensions.
And Sarah Brennan from Dalriada.
Thanks, Jade. Yeah, I'm based at Dalriada Trustee, a professional trustee, so involved in a bit of everything with pension schemes.
Wonderful. So just as a little bit of a reminder for everybody, last March, TPR published some detailed guidance to help trustees improve their equality, diversity and inclusion. The guidance provides practical ways and examples to help trustees improve the ED&I. It isn't legally binding, but it is quite a useful steer. The guidance touches on lots of different points that can be improved, but we're going to focus on a few of the key ones today. So if I can just bring everybody's attention to the role of the chair, which is going to be at the forefront of so many people's minds, particularly given now that we have the general code and a whole module on it. So the guidance from last year talks about the chair playing an important role in driving and promoting ED&I on trustee boards. I wonder, guys, from our panel, what is your experience of this? Have you seen this role really develop in this area? Are you expecting anything new to happen over the next few months or so?
I don't mind kicking that one off. Admittedly, that's a role that I do play in my day job. So I am that chair around the table. So I would hope to think that the discussions on ED&I were happening anyway, but certainly the guidance from TPR has really helped to focus the mind. And when you put it on an agenda, it's really helpful to be able to add that further justification about why we are spending everybody's valuable time and money to talk about it. So from my own point of view, D&I is something that I really value and have been advocating for some time, but it's really great to have that bit of guidance from TPR to be able to point to, certainly as well when we're looking at revising MND recruitment policies. You know, TPR has got some really great standard documents out there that trustees can use to help those conversations around the table. And of course, quite a few of the larger schemes have their MND policies publicly available. So there's lots of great tools to help those conversations along.
Yeah, and I think I found that when a chair does step in and really like vocally back that we've got this guidance and it is something that's important to them, the rest of the trustees are then much more happy to kind of get on board. If we think of a chair as almost the gatekeeper of an agenda, it's become a lot easier to get DE&I on agendas now. Kind of, I hate to call DE&I like a hot topic. It feels a little bit icky to imply that someone's lived experience is fashionable now. But it is becoming much more common. I'm seeing it on lots of agendas and seeing it as kind of a running agenda item rather than just something that we'll look at once, then tick a box and say, oh, we've done that now. We can move on to other things.
Just to give a slightly different angle on it, while agreeing with everything Katie and Sarah said, I've certainly seen it more cared about on trustee boards and among chairs because there's more awareness and there's the feeling that, oh, this is serious now. We're not going to let this just go away. It's going to be a thing we need to think about, but not necessarily. Many chairs are very good at that, but many are not necessarily better able at handling it. So with the best intentions, they aren't really equipped with the tools or the knowledge to be effective and make real change in that. So you have conversations where everyone's aware of it, but not really knowing how to better it or what that even looks like for them. And I've had some conversations for example, where the chair would say something like, oh, well, let's look around the table. Are we diverse? Well, we all went to different schools, or, well, some of us have actuarial backgrounds and some are from investment. That looks like diversity, doesn't it? So I think the intention is there, but there's also, with a hint of embarrassment, I think, people trying to sort of position themselves like everything's okay. And I hope to see it growing from not just being a recurring item on an agenda, which is great and is progress, but being integrated into every item on an agenda, really.
Yeah, and that really touches on the benefits of EDI, not just as a topic in and of itself, but the benefits that it brings to your boards and board decision making. But it's really positive to hear that it sounds like we are getting chairs who are there to set the tone for those kind of discussions and are trying to embed it in some ways, admittedly, maybe not always successfully. But that's, hey, there's always got to be something to build on, hasn't there?
One thing I was going to add, Jade, is it's still quite a lot of resistance. So even if you are the chair and you bring it to the table, as a chair, you have to listen to the voices and opinions around the table. And it might be that you are the only person around the table that feels like something needs to be done. So even though it is in the hands of the chair to some extent, it doesn't necessarily mean that positive action and change is going to happen. Advisors, I think, play a really key part as well in being able to support those conversations.
And I have found, because there's now such a lot of focus in TPR's guide, not just on the specific individuals on the trustee board, but what else you can do kind of outside of who the trustees are, that it's almost become a bit easier for trustees to say, okay, well, changing who our trustees are is too difficult. So let's look at comms, let's look at other things. And I think we should be looking at those as well. And that's great. And let's be more accessible in our communications. But ultimately, if we have a more diverse group of people sitting around the boardroom table, that is going to become, you know, those people are going to be making better decisions and making kind of more effective decisions to have better outcomes for members. So I think, not that I want to say it's a flaw of the TPI guide, because I think it is great that there's so much else we know we could be doing as well. We can't forget that actually we do want to try and make that board as diverse as possible.
Yeah, completely agree. And I think that brings us nicely onto the idea of an EDI policy. So TPR's guidance on EDI policies is that generally they help to ensure that everyone is clear on what behaviour is expected of them and helps to solve problems as they arise. And once it's implemented, if it's implemented properly, it gives people confidence that there's a commitment to treating people fairly and making sure that EDI is firmly on the agenda. Now, I'd be interested to know whether any of our panellists have seen EDI policies in practice, whether they've been standalone, built into something else, and how you feel that sort of developed since TPR's guidance, and what you think might happen in the near future.
I've seen one or two, and I think it's great. It's proof that boards are taking this seriously. But ultimately, it's the schemes that are happy to write the policies have lots to say in those policies because they're already doing a lot of work in this area. So it's kind of a self-selecting group. It would be quite hard, I think, for a scheme to write a policy if they're not doing anything. Like, the policy can't be the first step. But I would hope that over time, more schemes do start to look into this. Because as you said at the beginning, it's now in the general code. There's more of a focus on this. So I'd hope we'd get there. But at the moment, yeah, I've seen one or two.
I've seen quite a few, Jade. And in fact, at the moment, I'm currently revising a few of those policies with some of my trustee boards. And the guidance has been really great to help to bring up some challenging discussions. So TPI's guidance has in there some suggestions on maximum terms. So it's really helpful to be able to point towards that when you're talking about that to trustees, some of which might have been sat around the table for 20 years. So it's, you know, it's good to have something to be able to point to. Not saying that that's always changed what's in the policy, but it's helpful wording to be able to start those conversations and again, listen to everybody's opinions around the table. Although I should say, from my experience of late, it can take quite a lot of dialogue and interpretation to try and get policies up to date.
Yeah, and I suppose there's kind of a key thing here in that this is TPR guidance. It's not statutory guidance, and it obviously isn't a legal obligation to have these policies. So that, I suppose, really goes to your point, Katie, that it does kind of encourage the people who are doing something well to showcase that, and we would encourage that too. But if it's not really a key topic for you, or perhaps something that you're struggling with, it might be something that, you know, kind of sits to the side for a little while. So I don't know if there's anything else now that we're kind of a year on, and we've got some EDI policies out there, but not necessarily everybody has taken that on. For those that have, are you seeing people sort of test those policies, look at successes? I guess we're only just a year on, so it might not be quite, it might not feel like quite the right time to review and revise anything just yet. But I'd be interested to see what's been happening in practice for you guys.
So I haven't yet had a scheme that's almost tested a DEI policy, but one scheme I work with really closely, I'd like to say we were doing lots of work on this before the guidance came out. So they're a very good scheme. They do take this seriously. And they realised actually the diversity of their board in no way reflected the diversity of the scheme. And so we did a lot of work around the MNT communications. And this actually followed a panel talk that I saw Joe do a couple of years ago. And he was really like fighting the good fight for MNT roles, sounding more appealing. So we looked back at the MNT comms, which I have to say were not originally drafted by LCP. And took out all of the really like horrible, legal, scary wording of you will be responsible for this and you will be liable for that, and changed it all into, you know, this is what you might get out of the role and this is what a person who might be really well suited to this role could look like. So instead of saying you must have XYZ, it was like, these are the kind of softer skills that you might have that would make you a really good MNT. Do you like learning things? Do you like, you know, putting your hand up and learning about new topics and ultimately helping people. And we had so many more people apply, so many more women apply, and so many more non-white people apply for the first time. So it was kind of nice. I felt quite vindicated that it all worked, because a couple of the trustees, I think, had some questions. I don't know whether they necessarily took it as seriously as we wanted them to begin with, but it was such nice, solid proof that it did, you know, it was really meaningful and it worked. And we now have a slightly more diverse trustee board than we did at the beginning. So hopefully in a couple more MNT exercises time, the board might look a little bit more like the scheme.
It's just great hearing from Katie that you've put that into practice, and we've done similar things with clients of ours who've been specifically looking at that. And to take a step back for a second, the reason that an MNT exercise is really useful is because the outcome is quite measurable, and you can look at how many applications you get, and you can look at what sort of applications you're getting, how many women, for example. So you can see whether what you've done has had an effect. And then if you've learned lessons from doing that, you can take some of the things you're doing into all of your other comms, where the result might be slightly less measurable, but you have confidence that what you're doing has a positive effect on including everybody. The other thing I'll say is that if you do the things that Katie's talking about, and there are other tools as well that you can use to make something like an MND exercise more accessible and open to a much broader cross-section of society and of people. If you do all those things, what we found is you don't put off the people who were applying before. So you don't get fewer middle-aged white men. What you do is you bring everybody along with you. And it's really interesting seeing simple things like, if you have a look online at male coded language and female coded language, they call it male and female. But actually what happens is if you change the language from what you would traditionally say is male coded, so you're talking about things like the challenges, being driven, your fearless individual focused language. And if you change that to talking about being committed and collaborating and the sharing responsibility and understanding and all sorts of things like that, it doesn't just shift the audience from male to female. You don't put the men off, but you also open it up to not just women, but to, it turns out, people of all different backgrounds and ethnic minorities. So calling it male-coded language and female-coded language is slightly misleading because you think it's just the male-female split, but it's actually all of the minorities that you want to involve in those conversations.
Some really great tips there, Joe, on the communication. One of the schemes I've been working on at the moment for revising their policy, it turned out that their policy served two purposes. It was a policy, but it was also the member communication. So we're doing some work at the moment to revise that to make it more engaging when a member opens the letter to tell the members we want them to get involved, not just to throw the legal jargon at them, but to help them to try and understand what the role is. And to also set out as well examples of some of the softer skills that makes a good trustee that they themselves might be able to bring to the table, because admittedly, the technical aspect of it is something that we can help them to achieve. But actually, if you set out some of the softer skills, it might not look as scary to some members when they get that through the post. So communication's a massive element of making this a more inclusive process.
So it's really interesting that we're not seeing necessarily a huge uptake on EDI specific policies, but we are generally seeing moves across the market to make the MND process or MNT process much more open and inclusive. It's really interesting to hear all the different techniques that are being used by different schemes and what might work for one scheme might not necessarily work for another. So really important to kind of study your own scheme, your own population, what you've said in the past, what how you might be able to improve it. And I think this actually brings us really neatly onto the sort of next part of TPR's guidance, which looks at succession planning. And obviously there's generally that there seems to be quite a general move for succession planning on the trustee board in terms of MNTs. Have you seen any other kinds of succession planning going on, particularly perhaps in terms of lining somebody up to be a deputy or the next chair? Or even perhaps, Sarah, as you've said, if you're cutting tenures down, the idea of people just rotating more generally, how has that been received, and are you seeing any interesting things in practice?
I think certainly trustee boards and sponsors are opening up to the idea of having professional trustees on board. I think that's a great way for them to be able to bring somebody in, not only that person in, but more often than not, a company that sits behind them. So it's not just the person sat at the table, it's all of the diverse people behind. I think that's a great way to be able to help with the succession planning on trustee boards.
Yeah, completely agree, Sarah. That makes a lot of sense.
I think the other thing I'd add is generally across succession planning, but also the MNT exercises and more broadly, it's to look at what you're saying about these things and how you're talking to people about them to bring them into the conversation and make it possible to feel like it could be part of their future. But also look at how that then marries with the process that you've got in place. Because we have a lot of experience of making all the changes that we can to make the language positive and to make something feel as accessible as possible. But then when someone actually goes through the process, there are obstacles along the way that are much more powerful blockers of having more diverse candidates make it through the process. So it's got to be both, I think.
Yeah, so that could be, for instance, even if you've done every meeting you've ever had in person, obviously bar COVID times, it might be that actually hosting some meetings online makes it much more accessible to people who have young children, for instance, or who are not based around the headquarters of the sponsoring employer. Those kind of practical issues that actually have quite a big impact when somebody is looking to make what can be a very long commitment to a trustee board. I think, you know, it's it's at least a couple of years normally, your tenure. So that's quite a big commitment, as I say, for some people who think, oh, I might have to drive X amount of miles or not be able to fully partake.
And also on that, I found it can be really helpful, and something that often isn't thought about is setting meeting dates around school holiday times and other religious holidays. Like, we're never going to have a trustee meeting on the 24th of December, but why do we not think about other religious meaningful dates that other people might be celebrating? And putting that in MNT comms as well, just say, so that you don't need to come and ask me to work around you, we will do it automatically, I think can be really meaningful.
The other helpful thing around succession planning is that a lot of schemes now have a journey plan in place. Their funding positions are a lot better and their end goal, whatever that may be, can be defined and refined. So actually putting that out there to prospect MNDs, Ts is another useful element to show MNDs what it is they'll be focusing on, and perhaps giving them some certainty about the time period for which they'll be expected to be a trustee as well.
Yeah.
Carry on.
I was just going to say, I think, so another aspect that is important to think about is in any big organisation, if we all think back to when you've taken over something from somebody else, inevitably there's been a bit of a handover period, a sort of how-to guide. You've probably met up with people in person and been, you know, gone to meet people. So I think the kind of, I want to say, normal standard approach of onboarding somebody shouldn't be lost just because we're talking about a trustee board. If anything, actually, it's kind of more important, because the trustee board's probably smaller than a lot of big organizations where you might have joined as a newbie.
And then what I was just going to say, following on from that, it's the idea of inclusion. Let's not forget the eye of DEI, that when someone is at the table or in a meeting on the screen, what are they there to do? They're not there just to represent whatever smaller group they happen to be part of. They're not there as a woman just to talk about what women need. They're there fully as a human and a fully functioning member of the organization in their own right. And I think it's really important to remember that you're not just bringing someone on board for what they can bring to the conversation about diversity or about their minority. It's got to be wholly inclusive. And for me, the outcome of diversity should be not where you try and do the fix. You've got to look back at the process and look at whether you are accessing your entire talent pool. If I can use a clumsy analogy, if you're making sausages, and you discover there's a whole load of horse meat in your sausages, you don't carry on doing the thing the same way and then try to take out the horse meat as they come off the conveyor belt. You look back at your process and you're, how did all of this horse meat get into our sausages? And you make the fix higher up the chain. And I think we're not really yet doing enough of that. We're looking at the outcome and going, oh, well, I need to tinker with it here. Let's change it like that. And then when you have someone else who comes in, you might not fit the same box that everybody else has been up to that point. I haven't seen enough of recognizing that person is there to contribute in the round 100% in the same way as everybody else, and they're not just there because they have opinions on what it's like for young people or what it's like for women or whatever it may be.
There are, of course, vegetarian and vegan alternative sausage.
But no, it's a really good point, Joe. I think it's a reminder that we can't just sort of look at the end situation and without analysing how did we get to this particular point. And that, as I say, is important not just for your sort of MNTs, but even when you look at who's chairing the meetings, who's taking control of subcommittees, what subcommittees are they taking control of, and making sure that you've got that sort of diversity, including cognitive diversity, running all the way through the trustee governance structure. I think that brings us nicely onto, speaking of governance structures, onto looking outside of the trustee board. Now, obviously, apart from Sarah, who is a professional trustee, the rest of us sit outside of the trustee board. So this could be a bit of an interesting one where we go trustee versus advisors. But what have you seen in practice in terms of perhaps, Joe, Katie, what are you hearing from your clients in terms of diversity of the people advising? And Sarah, is there anything in particular that you are super, super keen on when it comes to working with your advisors and their diversity offerings?
So I think we are starting to quite justifiably get some pushback from trustees now, where we could often put forward a very diverse client team at a pitch, for example. But if in the, you know, the trustee meeting room, it's only ever going to be the 50-year-old white man at the top that is in the room and is seen, then is it actually as diverse a team as we've made it out to be? So I think it's important not to be kind of tokenistic in the diversity of the teams you're putting across. Make sure everyone on the team is visible as far as that's possible. And what I've actually seen some clients do recently is start thinking almost about succession planning of advisors, because, you know, somebody could become a schematry at 40, for example. They might have another 25 years being schematry of that specific scheme. So we want to keep it fresh. So I'm seeing some clients now considering almost putting term limits in of a schematry, for example. So you make sure you've got those people underneath the person at the top ready to come in and take that place. So everyone on the team is being given opportunities and you're not always seeing and hearing from the same voice.
I think that's really important, Kate, because one thing that I was going to add to this conversation from a trustee perspective is challenging ourselves on advisor reviews. So challenging ourselves on which advisors we include in those processes, challenging our own conscious and unconscious bias about which firms we go to, and not just going to somebody that we know that we've worked to before, but actually asking them to put forward the people that they think are right for the role, because admittedly, we don't know everybody that works in every advisory firm. So asking the right ED&I questions and giving advisory firms the chance to be able to put their best people forward for the role, I think is really important.
I think it's important to make it a conversation as well. It's really good to have seen it suddenly become something that's really important to an organization hiring advisors, that it's on the list of things they're going to be looking at and I hope asking about, so they're not just making judgments about the faces that have been put in front of you, but about, as I said, what sits behind that, what your priorities are, hopes are, processes are. And that way, even for an advisory firm that doesn't have all of those things in place and doesn't have a good approach to diversity, they know why and they know those things are important. And the more we talk about it, the more things are going to change for the better.
Yeah, and I think following on from that, certainly in my own experience, when you've been pitching for work or perhaps out meeting your already, you know, your existing clients, it's really good to have a difference of approach between the advisors that are there, because you can kind of ping off of each other and just come to things with a new perspective. And certainly as somebody who's at the more junior end of the team, it's really nice to have your own voice and be recognized for something that you are saying, rather than just sort of, you know, nodding your head and going along with the expert in the room. I think it gives you, as the junior person, more of a personality and makes you much more memorable.
And it's crucial that those opportunities are given to everybody as well.
Completely. So I think that's a really good roundup of the role of the chair, how we're expecting that to develop, EDI policies, whether they're really being used, but certainly changes in the approach to succession planning. And that's not just on the trustee board itself, but also, as we've discussed, amongst other advisors. I think what would be great is if we could leave our audience today with a practical tip from everybody here on taking this forward. For my 2 pence, I think it's worth remembering that, just like starting a new job, joining a trustee board or perhaps even joining as a junior advisor can be quite a daunting process when you walk into a room of people who know what they're doing. And let's be honest, pensions is quite a technical, tricky industry to be a part of. So just remember, there are lots of ways you can try and make that person feel welcome. For instance, new trustees, before they actually start, you could consider shadowing or buddying up, or just arranging calls and coffees between your new trustees and your advisors to make sure that they've seen those faces before and they can feel that they're in a position where they can ask what they might think is a silly question before having to do it in front of the entire trustee board.
Completely agree, Jade. My suggested takeaway is to be an ally to someone. What actually did come to mind is when you're on the train going to London and you get over the announcement, and this hopefully isn't bordering on plagiarism and hopefully the British Transport Police aren't after me, but to see it, say it, sort it.
Yeah, that's a really good tip, Sarah.
Not too cheesy.
No.
I like it. I think my point would be, so linking back to something that Jo said earlier about chairs probably having the best intentions for maybe not having the tools, get some behavioural bias training. It's been one of the most like impactful training sessions I've seen lots of boards have. So I think it can be really hard in pensions to know if we've made the right decision, because ultimately we often don't know until the very last member dies if the decisions we've made have been correct. And hopefully we'll be around at that point and still working with lots of these pension schemes. And that means that you don't get the vindication of knowing that your decision was correct, but also maybe means that we don't know if a decision that we made was wrong. And we all have different biases, but I think a more diverse room is probably less susceptible to specific behavioural biases because you all have different ones. And getting this training, I think, allows people to recognise biases both in themselves and in the board. So what I see a lot now is what I think it's called status quo bias or endowment bias, where boards have a tendency to prefer things to stay the same or kind of overvalue what they've already got. So your decision can turn into, we've considered the pros and cons. We want to keep our current advisor for XYZ reason, but you know, we'll keep it on the agenda and we'll keep thinking about it. Or maybe a tendency and a bias to kind of bend to perceived expertise. So, you know, lay trustees just agreeing with a professional trustee if they've said their opinion first. So a really simple change I've seen lots of chairs do is just the professional trustee says their opinion last in the room. So lay trustees have to think about what they think first. And they're not just going to agree with the person who has some letters after their name and might have had a 40-year career in pensions.
That sounds great. And I agree with all of those brilliant points from Sarah and Katie. For me, I think there are some easy wins in looking at the way you talk to people. I don't mean face-to-face, I mean the way that you communicate with members or with advisors or with potential trustees or actual trustees. It's not going to solve everything, but I think you can get a long way by looking at how you put information across. Are you talking about people rather than processes? Are you writing or talking like an actual human? So rather than focusing on the diversity conversation, broaden it out, and it will bring diversity along with it as a solution as you bring everybody along. Putting people in generally, talking about you, just putting the word you in so someone can picture themselves as part of this, whether it's the world of pensions or a specific role as an MND or MNT, whatever it might be, and looking out for those unintended messages that put up blockers to people. But then ultimately, the most effective way to do that is to ask people, and I'd encourage you to do that as one quite easy thing to take away. Is just involve them in the conversation, just talk to them. You don't have to talk to everybody, just talk to a few people and say, how does this land with you? What do you think about this? What's stopping you doing this? Or what's stopping you feeling like you're involved? And feeling is the important word there.
So thanks everybody for your practical hints and tips. I think we can all agree that TPR's guidance has been a really helpful tool in getting this conversation on the agenda, but there's still work to be done and progress to be made. Hopefully, in light of the general code, Edie and I will come back onto the agenda again with some force. And I look forward to hopefully catching up with you all and seeing how that's gone in a couple of months' time.